There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world to come and don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, it's Progressive News Network. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. And tonight, we salute women's rights and health care. We've got some really special guests. We've got Gretchen Borschelt, Senior Counsel and Director of the State Reproductive Health Care Policy, National Women's Law Center. We've got Dr. Maureen McKenna, President of the Democratic Women's Club of Florida. We've got Heidi Williamson, Senior Policy Analyst for the Women's Health and Rights Program at the Center for American Progress. And also Dr. Ellen Schaefer, Director, Trust Women, Silver Ribbon Campaign, and Co-Director of the Equal Health Network, and an Assistant Clinical Professor at the University of California, San Francisco. And now the news. NHK World News, October 2nd. High radiation levels in rainwater overflow. The operator of Fukushima Daiichi plant says it's detected high levels of radioactive substances in water that's overflowed from the storage container on Tuesday. 4 tons of tainted water seeped into the ground before workers halted pumping. TEPCO said it found 390 becquerels per liter of beta-ray emitting substances believed to be mostly strontium, much higher than the government limit for releasing strontium-tainted water into the ocean, which is set at 30 becquerels. That's 30 versus 390 becquerels. Item 2, NHK Newsline, October 2nd. They say that workers at Fukushima Daiichi have been pumping it into the wrong container. Crew may have transferred it into the wrong container, leading to an overflow. The level was 13 times higher than the government safety limit for releasing tainted water into the ocean, and for some reason the level of radiation in the rainwater had doubled since measurements were taken just after the storm. Plant managers are looking into what caused the spike. By the way, to get all the news items we were going to read tonight, go to avaryvoice.com, and you can see all the news items, many more than we can actually get to in a show because we have such a fact-filled presentation for you tonight. Fairwind's chief engineer, Arnie Gunderson, October 1st. Problem right now is that Japanese researchers are afraid to tell the truth. We've got doctors calling us at Fairwind saying, we know our patients have radiation illness. The hospital isn't allowing us to tell the patients that. So the last piece of this is transparency. And frankly, if you leave it to the Japanese government, we're never going to get transparency. He said, we've got to get people involved with an oversight panel made up of civilians who have nothing to gain or nothing to lose. Professor Hideo Yamagaze, Kinki University, says he's estimated concentration levels to be so low they in U.S. waters, but the fact they found contaminated fish off the coast of the U.S. has really shocked them. Also, there's many other things. There's been over 3,000 people with nosebleeds, continuous nosebleeds in the Fukushima region. Of course, they say there has nothing to do with the radiation. 36,000 children have tested positive for thyroid nodules, but of course, they also say has nothing to do with it. On the local front, hundreds of community leaders and residents joined airport workers in a rally against poverty wages at Fort Lauderdale International Airport. Airport's profits are soaring as black workers of Caribbean descent, especially Haitian and Jamaican, make up a low-wage workforce. Haitian American leaders will lead over 200 workers and residents in a rally against poor working conditions and poverty wages at the Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport. I do want to play a story with Senator Warren in it regarding TPP. So here we go. Senator Warren on Trans-Pacific Partnership.
I rise today to talk about trade agreements and the impact they have on our economy. Trade agreements affect access to foreign markets and our level of imports and exports. They also affect a wide variety of public policy issues, everything from wages, jobs, the environment, the internet, to monetary policy, pharmaceuticals, and financial services. Many people are deeply interested in tracking the trajectory of trade negotiations, But if they don't have reasonable access to see the terms of the agreements under negotiation, then they can't have any real input. Without transparency, the benefits of an open marketplace of ideas are reduced enormously. I am deeply concerned about the transparency record of the U.S. Trade Representative, and with one ongoing trade agreement in particular, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. For months, the Trade Representative who negotiates on our behalf has been unwilling to provide any public access to the composite bracketed text relating to the negotiations. Now, the composite bracketed text includes proposed language from the United States and also from other countries, and it serves as the focal point for negotiations. The Trade Representative has allowed members of Congress to access the text, and I appreciate that, but there's no substitute for public transparency. I've heard the argument that transparency would undermine the Trade Representative's policy to complete the trade agreement because public opposition would be significant. In other words, if people knew what was going on, they would stop it. This argument is exactly backwards. If transparency would lead to widespread public opposition to a trade agreement, then that trade agreement should not be the policy of the United States. I believe
we're going to leave Senator Warren there and her TPP statement because we do have a special announcement by Christopher Cano, who's working not only on the immigration rally that just occurred, but also on one for this coming week. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Christopher Cano. Christopher, welcome.
Hey, how you doing, Rick? Thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure, sir. Why don't you tell us about that rally you just had?
Yeah, well, yesterday we had a phone bank here in Tampa from about 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. trying to get people to a rally that we had in Lakeland. It actually was more of a prayer vigil than it was a rally, but we had a lot of passionate speakers, and people stayed there all night, all the way up until Sunday morning service this morning to go to, you know, church and go to breakfast after services. And we're just hoping that Congressman Ross, you know, will do the right thing and support comprehensive immigration reform in the House with some of his other Republicans who have pledged to do it and make sure that there's an earned path to citizenship in that bill.
And I understand you have a rally coming up.
We do. It's actually going to be not so much a rally, but a town hall style lecture series at the University of South Florida. And it's going to be on October 17th at 6:30 p.m. We've assembled an expert panel on immigration reform, and we actually have 14 student organizations partnering together to make this happen. It's actually going to be the largest student-run event ever at the University of South Florida.
Oh, excellent. Why don't you tell us the name of the event and how people can what time is the event?
Yeah, the event is called Students United, Our Country, Our Movement. The event's going to be on October 17th. That's a Thursday at 6:30 p.m. in the evening in the Marshall Student Center on the fourth floor in the Student Government Senate Chambers. The event, there's going to be free food available. If you want to know more about the event, yeah, you can definitely type it in on Facebook. There's a Facebook event for it. Or you can even get in touch with me through our Me Familia Volta offices here in Tampa.
Why don't you go ahead and give them that that Facebook address one more time?
Yeah, it's Students United, Our Country, Our Movement.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Chris, and best of luck with your event.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on. Take care, Chris.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, next up we've got Gretchen Borschalt, Senior Counsel and Director of State Reproductive Health Care Policy, the National Women's Center. An amazing woman. Wait till you hear this presentation. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Gretchen Borschalt, Senior Counsel and Director of the State Reproductive Health Policy at the National Women's Law Center. Ms. Borschalt, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
May I call you Gretchen?
You can, yeah.
Thank you so much, Gretchen. Women's rights, family reproductive care. why do you think this country is relitigating what we worked on over 100 years ago? What the heck is going on?
It's unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, I cannot believe we are still having these same fights. This year is the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, and yet it seems like we're taking a step backwards. It's really unbelievable. And it's not just about abortion. I mean, we have seen attacks on women's access to birth control. Birth control. It's really unbelievable. And I think a lot of it has to do with how extreme politicians have become. The anti-abortion folks are just no holds barred. And partly it's because the state legislatures have gotten so conservative. We saw a huge upswing in conservative legislatures, and they now control 21 states are anti-choice in the legislatures and in the governor's office. And so you can imagine they feel like they have this ability to push things through, and they're doing it.
You know, I think of Margaret Sanger smuggling condoms from France in wine bottles, you know, so long ago. And, you know, I think that Miss Sanger must be spinning in her grave. That this same battle would be taking place after it was resolved so many times. You know, I half think that the reason we haven't gotten to women's pay equity and the rights of families to have child care, simply because we're still relitigating what happened 100 years ago.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And, of course, all of those things are interconnected, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, you know this better than anyone. If a woman doesn't have good pay, she can't afford child care. And if she needs reproductive health care and she can't afford it, then that's going to factor in. So everything is connected in women's lives and the lives of their families, too.
And, you know, I think there's some very important social issues that started to get sorted out in the 60s and 70s. Where the responsibility for child care, where the responsibility of birth control, what impacts women's equity can make in building a better society. And as you suggested, with these state legislators becoming so much more conservative, they want to refight the battles of the 1700s and 1800s. They don't even want to talk about the 60s. I mean, forget that. And when you think about how much our society could benefit from fair treatment of women, if just women's pay equity happened, and instead we're fighting over, you know, can you have access to breast cancer screening? It's absolutely appalling. And I think those of us who believe in human rights for all people of all sexes, we have one hell of an uphill battle to fight, because these people want to drag us back to the 1500s.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Now, just recently, with these new constraints on healthcare, and of course with the whole healthcare debate, I heard recently that they're saying they want to give corporate authorities the decision-making power over whether your company health insurance can cover women's issues.
Oh, yes. It's unbelievable. So, you know, the healthcare law makes great strides for women. There's so much that women and their families are going to gain across the country and in Florida. I mean, women in Florida are going to be so much better off thanks to the Affordable Care Act. Just as an example, in Florida, before, no individual market plan covered maternity care. Now, it's a requirement. So women are going to be able to get access to maternity care. It's part of the coverage that they are guaranteed by the Affordable Care Act. The other guaranteed coverage is what you're mentioning, which is women now have the ability to get birth control coverage in their insurance plan. All new plans have to cover birth control. But what we're seeing is this effort by for-profit companies. So these are, I mean, the range of companies is unbelievable. It's mining companies. It's Hobby Lobby, the big craft store chain. These bosses are saying, we don't want women to have access to birth control. We believe birth control is wrong. We don't think we need to cover it. And so they've gone to court, and they're suing to stop women that work for them from getting this benefit. So if you work for a boss who thinks it's wrong, he gets to decide that you don't get coverage for birth control. And there are almost 80 cases that have been filed in court to try and stop this. And we expect it to go to the Supreme Court. It's unbelievable.
You know, I refuse to put the fault on the progressive side at all. Because we've been doing and saying the right thing about fairness, about equity, about equal treatment, well, at least for the last, let's say, 50 years, you know, pretty consistently. And yet what we see is this, you know, I'm trying to stay polite about it, but this lurch backwards to the 19th century, let's think for a second. Where does this go? Where do these people want to take us? What do you think?
Oh, I think they want women to be at home, barefoot and pregnant, right? We're going back to this, women shouldn't be in the working world, they shouldn't be paid as much as men, they should be home with the babies. I mean, it really is a very disturbing and backwards mindset that we're seeing. And I think that's the world that they think is best, and we have to tell them, no, they're wrong. It is not best.
You are Senior Counsel and Director of State Reproductive Health Policy. Obviously, you're pleased about some of the direction that the current new health program is going to take. If you had your magic wand, and I'm betting you do, what improvements would you like to see in the next version of a version 2.0 of this healthcare?
You know, it does so much for women that it really takes care of a lot of problems that we've seen before, like the maternity care. Another thing that it does, it says plans can't deny coverage to adults with pre-existing conditions. So women won't be treated as a pre-existing condition. Being a woman, not a pre-existing condition. So you can't be denied coverage if you have a history of pregnancy or you had a C-section or you're a survivor of breast cancer. Or we even saw insurance companies denying women coverage if they were victims of domestic violence or sexual assault. So we have taken care of a lot with this healthcare law. But one of the problems was that the Supreme Court decided that the Medicaid expansion that would give more low-income people access to health insurance was an option for states. And Florida is not one of the states that's moving forward with Medicaid expansion. They're not taking the money. They have decided to leave these people without health insurance. And so I think the next step would be to reach those people who are going to be in this gap between being not poor enough to qualify for regular Medicaid, but don't make quite enough to go into the health insurance marketplaces that were set up for individuals.
With these constant threats to women's rights, women's health care, you know, these battles, do we take it to the state? I mean, obviously, you can only take this particular Supreme Court to do the right thing, I'm afraid, for in terms of whether it be pay equity or authority of corporate versus human rights. Where do you think the battle needs to be joined next? Is it basically just the courts?
Well, here's the good news, I will say. I try to always have a positive, and we do have a positive
thank you,
here.
Thank you so much.
So, you know, we've seen these outrageous attacks in the states. I mean, I could run through a whole litany of all the attacks. I mean, Texas, we saw what they did there. In North Dakota, they passed a law that's going to ban abortion as early as 6 weeks in pregnancy before most women even know they're pregnant. Arkansas passed a ban on abortion at 12 weeks. I mean, these state legislatures are out of control in terms of attacking women's health care and putting their agenda ahead of women and the health care they need. But what we've seen come out of this is a very engaged and enraged new generation of activists. And it's been helped by social media. You know, we have seen how social media has really changed the landscape of activism and awareness. And these people are upset and they are ready to do something. They are marching to the capitals. They are protesting. They're going to protest at the governor's houses in North Carolina. They protested at the governor's mansion when he passed an anti-abortion bill because he had said in his campaign he wouldn't. So people are not kind of taking it anymore. They're letting their voice be heard. And we have a campaign that's called This Is Personal that aims to engage these previously inactive people who are now learning what is happening and getting outraged. And what we found through our campaign is that it's not an intensity gap, it's an information gap. That is that some people don't know what's going on. And once they learn about it, either through our campaign, This Is Personal, or through shows like this where you talk about it, people are outraged, and they want to take action. They will sign petitions. They will send letters to their legislature. They will do what they need to do to let their voice be heard. And the ultimate goal, I think, is that they, you know, take action at the ballot box, too, and let their votes tell these legislators that enough is enough and that they have gone too far.
One of the things that I find most troubling, I come at this with a very strong interest in human rights and the Constitution, but also my other bias, and I'm going to call it a bias in this day and age, is science. And many of us say, well, look, here's the facts. Well, unfortunately, for some of these political figures, I can't call them leaders, I choke on saying that. Some of these political factions, they seem immune to facts. They ignore science. Science is, you know, not part of their worldview. We just saw in the last presidential election where not one Republican presidential candidate would even admit to believing, quote, believing in evolution. How do you take facts to people like that? I suppose that we just have to continue to press the case for a humane society. I salute your work. God knows, salute your work.
Well, it's not easy, and I think you've hit on it exactly. These legislators, these politicians, they're not interested in facts. They're not interested in science. They're not interested in medicine or the will of the people of the state. They have an agenda, and they're pushing it no matter what. And so, you know, I was joking with some other advocates the other day, they don't take fact sheets up to the state capitals anymore because the legislators aren't even interested in reading them. They don't care about the facts. They don't care about the constitutionality of a bill that they could be advancing. They don't care if it's factual, if it'll hurt women. What they care about is their agenda. And so what we do now is bring people with T-shirts and with posters and with signs. That gets through to them, where facts, frankly, just don't. It's terribly depressing.
I've always, you know, felt that one of the blessings of democracy is that, you know, you can share information. To me, information includes facts. It's not a fact-free zone. So, you know, I find myself in a situation where, you know, all right, let's look at the facts. Well, looking at the facts seems to be, unfortunately, irrelevant for these people. And theology has its place. It can serve an important role in society. And for many people, it's their environment. It's their living space. And that's wonderful for them. But unfortunately, when these theocrats presume to bring their theology to play in the public space, that's where we have to stand up and say, no, that's not what this country's about. Let me ask you this. You know, you working in family planning, your work in reproductive care, you know, we've seen these great advances in science, and yet right now, as long as there's old white guys deciding the rules, you know, we're not going to make that kind of progress, unfortunately. Obviously, getting more women in office is going to be crucial. Do you see any bright stars on the horizon, either in the legislature or in state governments, where women are there other women standing up and taking this battle on?
There are. You know, Texas has a bunch of good women legislators. I know Wendy Davis has gotten a lot of the attention, but there are other very strong women in the state legislature there who spoke up and stood alongside her. And so we've seen that in other states as well. And one other positive, I think, from these fights is that we not only have a new generation of activists, but we have a new generation of young people who might be interested in getting into politics. And so to the extent that this activates and motivates those people, I think can only be a good thing for us, that young women are saying, this is enough, and I'm going to step in and try to make things different.
Well, you know, that's a good way to look at it, because I think when you see these the politicians overreaching, where they did all these incredible, quote, database purges of voters, it really motivated people to come out. And
okay,
Hopefully that's the antidote to this 17th century thinking, you know. Can you give us some other positive, hopeful signs on the horizon that you can give to our audience? We have people here who care, and unfortunately living in Florida as we do, by and large, we live in a very backward state.
Well, Florida voters have already told their politicians that they don't want extreme restrictions on abortion. Just last year, voters there voted down an attempt to allow politicians to get between a woman and her doctor and take insurance coverage abortion away from women who already have it. So Florida voters let their voices be heard, and they accomplished something. And I think we're seeing that across the country now. When they try and take these issues to the voters, they're being shut down. For example, in Colorado, they tried to pass really extreme bans on abortion. Voters have shut those down twice. Even in Mississippi, they tried it and failed. And so I think that they're getting the idea that voters, when actually confronted with the extreme kinds of things that they're pushing, sometimes secretly through the legislature, that voters don't support it. And I think you mentioned kind of, you know, voter suppression efforts. I think what we're seeing across the board is that voters in this country are saying our legislators should not be focusing on these divisive issues. They should be spending their time on the country's priorities, improving the economy, reducing the deficit. This is enough of these really, you know, social issues that take away time from what really matters. And so I'm hopeful, and I think, you know, we should be optimistic that that message will get through, either at the ballot box or in some other way.
Well, I absolutely applaud your optimism. Let me ask you about another critical issue. Talk briefly about the idea that there are those who want to give Americans, supervisors, the decision-making power over whether we can access birth control or health care. There's also a movement to give pharmacists and other health care workers the right to refuse someone care. Where is that issue these days? I haven't heard too much about it in the last few months.
Yeah, it's died down a little bit. And we saw, you know, it was a big issue a couple of years ago where we heard of a bunch of cases of women who go into the pharmacy to pick up their regular birth control prescription or to purchase emergency contraception. And pharmacists just say no, that they would refuse to provide women with their birth control. And as you can imagine, women were, first of all, shocked and surprised. They often didn't even realize what was going on. They would say, well, what do you mean I can't get my prescription? I'm here. I'm paying for it. And then when it became clear that they were refusing based on their own belief and religious belief and personal beliefs about birth control, women were outraged and humiliated. And so we saw kind of a rash of states take up this issue. Florida has not addressed it, but a number of states have. Some allowed pharmacists to do this. Some prohibited pharmacists from doing it. We had kind of a split in the states. And I think it goes back to your point that you were making about the imposition of religion. And the bottom line has to be that religion should not be used to discriminate. And that's what these pharmacists were doing. They were using their religious beliefs to discriminate against women who were trying to get access to their birth control. And it's the same with bosses refusing to cover birth control in their insurance plan. They are using their religion to discriminate against the women who need the coverage. And we've seen it not only in the reproductive rights field, but in other fields as well. So people who have religious beliefs against same-sex marriage, refusing to issue a license to same-sex couples, or refusing to photograph their wedding. You know, we've seen a real push, I think, among people that have strong religious views that their religion takes precedence over other people, and I think that that's wrong. And we know that we all have individual religious beliefs. It's just when it crosses the line of using your belief against somebody else's belief.
On a bright note, I've been absolutely overwhelmed by some of the statements out of the new Pope, where he said just the other day, well, you know, the Vatican should be less Vatican-centric.
Mm-hmm.
that maybe the church should be concerned about, you know, people instead of how important it is. And mm-hmm. I thought, well, you know, there's a bright spot from time to time. I think your campaign, this is personal, is a really interesting idea. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, thanks. So This Is Personal is basically a campaign that aims to educate and engage younger people who haven't necessarily been active in these issues before. And so we're trying to utilize social media, since we know that's where this population, you know, lives and breathes, and explain these issues in a very clear and concise and comprehensible way, and then give them easy ways to get active. So they can like our items on Facebook, they can share, we do a lot of infographics and easily digestible, very graphic images. And what we found is that once they learn what's going on, they are very eager to engage. And they move up the ladder of engagement, as we call it. So they'll first sign a petition, then they'll send a letter to their legislator. And it's really outpaced any kind of expectation we had in terms of engaging people and getting them involved. And I should say, even though it's targeted at younger women, it's open for anyone who's interested in these issues to become involved and active. And so I recommend that everybody visit the website www.thisispersonal.org to see the content, to learn about these issues, and to take action where they think that something outrageous is going on.
Well, that sounds like an excellent campaign. Let me ask you one other question, if I may. I've always felt it's important for people to understand how activists come to their work. And I often ask my activist guests, what was it in your life that made you decide you had to contribute? You know, for most people, just making a living, having a family, having friends is more than load enough. but sometimes some of us are imposed upon or called by karma, or whatever you want to call it, that we have to do something to make it better. What was it in your life?
You know, I actually don't have a moment that really engaged me in the way that I know a lot of people do. For me, it was more being raised by a family that believed that women could and should be equals and have all of the opportunities that men should have. And then going through my life and seeing in various ways that that was being taken away from women and that women weren't getting the opportunities. So it wasn't a one moment thing. It was a more of a lifetime of examples and the values that my parents instilled in me that it shouldn't be like that.
One of my daughters, when she was in high school, went to a program up in D.C. called Close Up, which was evidently a well-disguised conservative propaganda trip to indoctrinate children in conservative values. And she ended up taking on both Tom DeLay and Newt Gingrich in a debate.
Brave.
she's quite a gal. And later her teacher calls us up, and this is while they were still in D.C., and she said, you know, there's a big anti-choice protest going on down here in D.C., and your daughter wants to go oppose it. She and some friends are going to go counter-demonstrate for this big anti-choice. And she said, is that okay with you? She said it would be, and I said, oh, absolutely.
So you instilled values in her that clearly were coming out.
Absolutely. And my other daughter got her master's degree in international disaster psychology and has been working to help communities improve their mental health system. So I'm so proud of my two daughters. I have a wonderful wife, I have a wonderful mother, fantastic grandmother. I have been surrounded, I'm fortunate to be surrounded by really powerful women, intelligent women, creative women. And to me, if I didn't join the battle for women's equity, I would not respect and honor those fine women that I know. Is there any one thing you want to leave our audience with? How can they get in touch with the Women's Law Center, or should they really focus through the This Is Personal campaign?
This Is Personal campaign has all of the information and ability for you to connect with us. So again, it's www.thisispersonal.org. And I want to thank you for mentioning the important role of men, because this is not just about women. It's about the health of families and our society. And it's only if men step up here too, and we've seen some great male champions in some of these state legislatures and in Congress who have stepped up, and their role is so critical. And so thank you and all the men out there who are taking up this battle as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Gretchen Borscholt of the Senior Counsel and Director of State Reproductive Health Policy of the National Women's Law Center. And next, Dr. Maureen McKenna, President of the Democratic Women's Club of Florida. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Dr. McKenna. Welcome. How are you?
Good evening, Rick. How are you?
I'm very good. We have so many interesting challenges to American voters, American citizens, American women. Maureen, you've been involved in women's rights for a long time. You're very involved in the political efforts to make sure that women's voices are heard. Why don't you give us your take on the state of women in Florida and in the United States today?
Sure. Thank you very much, Rick. I am the president of the Democratic Women's Club of Florida, and in preparation for today, I reviewed our platform, and 5 of our 10 points in our platform impact or have to deal directly or indirectly with the women's public safety and access to health care. It's very important and a foundation of our platform for the Democratic Women's Club of Florida. Women have a secondary status in society which impacts the health of women and the loved ones who they take care of, those that are dependent on them. So it's said that all issues are women's issues. I say all women's issues are everyone's issues. And the UN issued a resolution indicating that access to contraception is a human right. It goes back to Hillary's famous quote that human rights are women's rights and women's rights are human rights. And in Florida, access to health care and life indicators of well-being have been continually challenged in the Florida legislature. We still don't have equal pay for equal work. Senator Arthemia Joyner has filed the Helen Gordon Davis Fair Pay Act to rectify this. That's Senate Bill 206. Pregnant women can still be discriminated against in Florida in employment and in housing because they have no protection under the law. Representative Lori Berman and Senator Geraldine Thompson have filed legislation to include pregnancy into the protected classes under the Florida Civil Rights Act, and that's House Bill 105 and Senate Bill 220. Democratic Women's Club of Florida will continue to advocate strongly and loudly to make sure that women who research has shown need more immediate, short, and long-term medical supports are not the ones who have the least access to health care, but adequate access to health care.
You know, so much of what's in the news today is focused around access to health care, and not to say there hasn't been some progress made, but I find it absolutely appalling that we are still fighting a battle that gets nowhere near women's pay equity. We're refighting battles from the 19th century on access to birth control, on citizenship. And, you know, every day we hear the word about this discrimination and that discrimination. Why do you think it is that conservative forces feel empowered still to insult the dignity of women?
I ponder that myself, why they feel that they have a latitude. I guess they still see us as a vulnerable population, and they're not looking at their demographics to see what is going to get them voted in. So it's poor planning on their part because, like I had said earlier, women have increased need to access health care supports of any kind throughout their lifetime. And so any attacks on Social Security, it's a direct assault on women because we live longer. Any assaults on access to long-term care, it's an assault on women because not only do we live longer, but research has shown that we may not have the economic or family support in place to live independently, so we need that long-term care. We need more mental support services, and Rick, my belief, and I'm sure there's research to back this up, that some of this access to mental health care is caused in part by the women's perceived diminished value at home, work, and society, and adapting to that status of being undervalued and being under assault, as I had just indicated. Because we live longer, we have to utilize Medicare, because women are more prone to living below the poverty level. We need access to Medicaid for our family and for ourselves. Homeless women are particularly vulnerable because they don't have access to preventative care. And even with the Affordable Care Act, migrant women are delayed from accessing health care for a period of time after they become a resident.
You know, in your work with the political forces, the Democratic Party, for example, I'm sure a big part of what you're doing is educating women about taking office, about taking on those legislative and civic responsibilities. Could you talk about the Democratic Women's Club and their work to not just get out the vote, but get out the candidates?
Our Democratic Women's Club of Florida has a few ways that we support women who run for office, progressive women. We have a political committee which actually disperses money to those that are endorsed candidates, and there's an endorsement process that one has to apply to be sure that you stand with our platform, the candidates stand with our platform. And if so, the endorsement goes then to the political committee who can dispense the money. We also have an advocate on board, Karen Weitzel, who is our candidate resource chair. And she has run for office and knows a lot about what kind of resources are out there for women. And sometimes women just need that mentoring. They need that person that they can call if they have a question about what to do. And we refer candidates that we endorse to Karen to get extra support. Then we, of course, campaign for them. Once we endorse them, we know about them, we mobilize and galvanize at the local club level and beyond to try to get them into office. An example of that would be at our recent state convention where I was elected president.
We Congratulations.
Thank you very much. When we were at the convention, we had phone banking for Amanda Murphy throughout the day, throughout the weekend, so that women had an extra few moments they could go in and make a few calls for her. And anything that we can do, we had Gwen Graham come to speak to us, and we donated money to her. We passed around a basket. We are phone banking and canvassing for her. And, of course, our Nan Rich, we have done as much as we can for her and continue to, and will always support Nan Rich's efforts as our only Democratic candidate that has declared thus far.
She's such a great progressive candidate. We certainly wish her the best.
And we're talking about health care access. Nan has gotten onto the honor roll or earned the honor roll status for Planned Parenthood and has been recognized for her advocacy for health care access for women and children.
If you were going to advise a young woman who's contemplating running for an office, what would some of the things be that you would suggest?
When women run for office, research has shown that they need to be asked, typically, to run for office a few times. But I feel that somewhat that is changing with the encouragement and all the supports that are in place in the community to help women that are who are progressive to run for office. And I think to answer your question, I think that it's important for them to know that the Democratic Women's Club of Florida and our resources are there for them, and knowing that they're not alone and they have help in navigating what they should be doing, and we can provide the resources and counseling to help them access those resources.
Dr. McKenna, I am so continually impressed by your work, the level of effort that you're doing, the broad band of projects that you're working on. I wonder if I can ask you a question. For most people just trying to make a living, trying to have a family, having a few friends, is more than enough to fill their plate to overflowing. There's a special kind of person out there, an activist, who, given all that, finds the time to contribute to their society, to make a better world. And I was wondering, what was it in your early life that gave you the impetus to put time into trying to improve how life is here for us?
Well, my background is in rehabilitation counseling. So I think all women have their own story about how they have become activists and how they feel that they can contribute to the change that they feel is necessary in our country. In working with veterans with service-connected disabilities and seeing the barriers that they had when they were trying to go into post-secondary training or employment, and the issues that they have dealt with from their military experience, and because of the issues they had with the disability and their family, it really showed me how much our country can do to serve the veteran in a more comprehensive way. It showed me a global view of some of the changes that need to occur in society. And I think that has proved to be an impetus for me to become more involved as a Democratic woman.
Well, I certainly appreciate that. Let me ask you one more thing. You know, you're a person that's been involved in this work for a long time. And I notice with my own self, I see so many of these battles fought again and again and again and again. Access to birth control, access to contraception, access to health care, the debate about food stamps, now called SNAP. And here we find ourselves in a time of economic stress, and part of the government is holding everything up simply so they can reduce the opportunity for people to have health care. It would seem like you'd have to be some kind of barbarian to think we'd be in better shape if less people had access to health care. As an educator, as an activist, what do you think drives that?
I ponder that quite a bit, because I feel what is good for the country is it's what is good for those that are most in need, and vice versa. And I don't quite get why they think that not supporting those in need and improving health care, access to health care, which in turn helps people become employable, which in turn helps the tax base, why they would do that. I don't understand. And again, because of the change in the demographics across our nation, why would a politician believe that would behoove them to vote against some of these important components of well-being for women? It's a continual fight, Rick. It's like the Democratic Women's Club of Florida with the Equal Rights Amendment and our continual fight to get it ratified in Florida. We're not going to go away. We're going to continue fighting for it. And it has been filed again with Lori Berman and Arsenia Joyner to try to get that heard in a committee and passed this year in legislature. We are not going to give up. And it will always be not necessarily a victory, but a postponement of disappointment. We will always continue to fight and rejoice in that ability to postpone their intent to take away rights, services, and access to health care for women.
Well, Dr. McKenna, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Is there any final words you want to leave for the audience?
I do, Rick. I would like to invite those to learn more about the Democratic Women's Club of Florida. We are very politically active. We are a strong group of women that are looking to make a change. And if you're a progressive man or woman in Florida, we are here for you. Join us. We need you. And I think you need us. So thank you, Rick.
We sure do. Thanks so much, Doctor. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Dr. Maureen McKenna, president of the Democratic Women's Club of Florida. Before I get on to our next guest, Ms. Heidi Williamson, senior policy analyst for Women's Health and Rights, the program for the Center of American Progress, I do want to mention our good, solid progressive journalist colleagues here, and want to mention to you, you should be tuning in to Gwen Holden Berry's show, Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and Roseanne's show, Progress Toward Democracy, Anita Stewart's show, Wise Women Media, Susan Nylon and the Nylon Report, Sita Beguile and Sita Media, Harriet Lerman and her show, The Voice of the People, and Rob Abston's Smile, It's Only Politics. These are all good progressives whose information is provided to serve you and help you be better informed as we face the dinosaurs who are trying to take as many with us as possible. Okay, and with that, I am happy to bring you Ms. Heidi Williamson. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Ms. Heidi Williamson, Senior Policy Analyst for Women's Health Rights Program at the Center for American Progress. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me. Such a pleasure.
It's our honor, believe me. We get to talk to you at such an interesting time in our country's evolution of healthcare policy. I know you've been working for a long time on healthcare policy. Why don't you give us your thumbnail sketch right now of where you see the healthcare policy evolving right now?
So right now, I'm really excited because I've actually been talking to people on the ground who have been attempting to sign up for healthcare online, and
excellent.
They've had difficulty doing so because servers are overwhelmed with people who are attempting to sign up, and that's really it's important to me. I think when we talk about the value of this healthcare law, what we're seeing is, for the first time in our nation's history, is a recognition of a coin that on one side sits economic justice and on the other side seeks sits reproductive health rights and justice. And particularly when we talk about the most vulnerable communities in this country, they for the first time have the ability to really move a step closer to health equity. Now, this is not the cure-all, but we do have better access now to health care that can give people the possibility of reducing some of the health care disparities that we see just tearing holes in communities of color across this country. And it starts with the ability to simply be able to afford to walk through the doctor's door and seek the preventative services that they need. And so I'm excited about it. This law by no means is perfect, but it is a great first step, I think, to making sure that women get the health care that they need, communities of color, and more importantly, teens. I think about the millennials who have the ability now to be the first generation to have affordable, comprehensive health care, and that is so valuable because I remember having to fight when I was in college in my 20s to stay on my mother's health insurance, and that was the biggest concern about would I find a job, would I be able to afford my health insurance, and now it's possible on several fronts, so I think that's critically important.
You know, it's such an interesting challenge for our country. Clearly, we see on the one hand those people who, under the guise of, quote, free market health care, have done basically everything they can to sabotage this. And
right.
At the same time, we see the American public clearly voting with their mouse clicks to participate.
Well, you know, I actually have these conversations quite frequently.
I'm sure you do.
Because I'm from Georgia. And I had the luxury, if you want to call it that, of watching some of the debate go down over the weekend around, you know, will the government shut down? I was in Savannah watching it with a bar full of people who wanted the Republican leadership in the House to shut the government down. And the reality is the majority are individuals who have never had to choose between health care and housing or health care and groceries. And unfortunately, it's challenging for them to put themselves in the shoes of people who simply have to make those decisions all the time, and health care is considered a luxury. And I think that it is a great day where we can now talk about health care in the context of law. We can talk about it in the context of it being a human right that is realized within the United States. And we can talk about a centering health and a cost-efficient health in a way that can actually help lift people out of poverty. I mean, people can go back to work when they're healthy enough to do so and healthy enough to stay in the marketplace. And so, if anything, I would think that people would want this because it actually is helping the workforce be more sustainable, have longevity. And at the end of the day, I think you have a number of people who look at our president, and for a number of reasons, are not going to accept Obamacare because of who pitched it, who sold it, and now it's law. And they're talking to a group of people who think only like them, who have experiences similar to them, and that's unfortunate. But the bottom line is, it's law, and we're on a roll. We're
you
here.
Know,
it's going downhill. We're getting it done.
I think that the Republicans may live long enough to regret calling it Obamacare.
Because progressives have completely reappropriated that. We love it now. And I think, you know, I love that we've been able to reappropriate that and turn it into something good. But I watched the Jimmy Kimmel skit the other night where they were asking people, you know, do you prefer to use Obamacare or an alternative? How about, you know, the Affordable Care Act? And people, you know, the average person just doesn't know, right? It's people who are plugged in and are in this particular matrix that understand the value of reappropriating the term and making it something that's positive. But I'm more concerned about the people who grew up in areas like I did in rural Northeast Georgia who still are not even aware that while they may be complaining about it because the people around them are complaining about it, they don't have health insurance.
Yeah.
And they need to go and apply, and they're not aware because of all of the misinformation that's out there.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the Women Health and Rights program that you're working on for the Center of American Progress.
Sure. Right now, I am the department, and we're humming along. because the program started, CAP officially is 10 years this year, but the program was started 8 years ago by Melody Barnes, who is a former staffer for the Obama administration and was also with the Clinton administration, to talk about health and rights in a new way and in a forward-thinking way. I came on board out of the reproductive justice movement to talk about health and rights more through a social justice lens, particularly as it pertains to women of color and vulnerable communities. And I'm fortunate to have a background also in the labor movement. And oftentimes what we see, is, you know, the people who are actually most affected and the people who are actually making the biggest sacrifice to keep a particular entity, a movement growing, are oftentimes not the ones necessarily reflected in the leadership of a particular movement. And so part of my job is to make sure that we have an analysis around the policies as they impact the most vulnerable women and girls, but to also lift up the most vulnerable and the people who are most affected by some of the laws that are being passed both at the state and federal level.
Well, let me ask you this. When we think about, you know, various communities and how, you know, this has so many positive aspects of the Affordable Care Act, when you think about communities of color, what do you think are the most important aspects of the ACA for communities of color?
Hands down, it's the access to preventative care. You know, the communities of color lead in every healthcare disparity that the CDC tracks. African American women in particular lead in everything from STI, HIV rates, cancer rates, unintended pregnancies. We also lead in abortion rates, and some of this is attributed to, number one, the inability to simply access the health care that is necessary to have a consistent and long-term relationship with health care providers. And so we want people to move beyond using the emergency room as the first point of entry into the health care system, and we also want people to own their health and be able to have a life and a healthcare journey where they're being empowered to make decisions in a proactive way rather than a reactive way. The Latina community also has incredibly high unintended pregnancy rates as well as high unintended birth outcomes. And we think about healthcare data like this, it's very easy to go down this path of blaming the people who actually are who have bad healthcare outcomes. And one of the things I'm passionate about and have spent most of my life doing is really talking about why the disparities look the way that they do. And the reality is, what you see is the greater the income inequality, the worse the healthcare outcome. And so we have to begin to talk about healthcare and healthcare disparities through this social justice lens, where we are ensuring that people have the economic means that they need in order to take care of their families, access the healthcare that they need, go to further their education in whatever way that may suit them, and enter into the market in a way where they can be parents if they choose to be, stay in the workforce as long as they want to. And unfortunately, we have too many women who are surviving and are having to choose between this sort of, do I stay in the workplace to take care of my family, or do I have to worry about the caregiving role? I mean, women now are officially more than 50% of the workforce, but the caregiving roles of women have not shifted, have not changed for the last 40 years. So we've got to think about how women are living their lives and make sure that the role healthcare plays in it is bolstering the lives that they want to live. And so for women of color in particular, because we're more likely to live in poverty, because we're more likely to have lack of access to health insurance, health education, health literacy, we have to be more vigilant to make sure that these populations have the information that they need to have the preventative services that they need, and then when something happens, have the best health care possible to move forward and get the care that they need so that they can be the women that they intend to.
you know, it's hard to think about the healthcare system, especially those free market proponents, without thinking about the pay equity issue and how important that is, and the economic drivers of this deficit in healthcare, as well as information and quality of schools, and it just kind of cascades from there. So there's this, you know, kind of quintupled whammy on communities of color, where they don't have the schools, they don't have the education, they don't have the resources, they don't have the availability, and they certainly have pay equity issues that are just monstrous that's still going on. So of course these people are going to be much more in need of health care.
And you forgot, women spend 68% more on health care than men. So for women of color, if we're making less money but we're spending more on health care, we're actually widening the income inequality gap. We're actually keeping people poor because we can't keep them healthy.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. What do you think, you know, obviously the income issues are such a big component of the health care dilemma. What do you think it's going to take to move this country toward a reality where women are finally being paid equitably? We are so behind the eight ball on this. I cannot believe that in 2013 we've made no more progress in this.
Right. I mean, I think some of it is, and I mean, this is a chicken and the egg argument.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm in an office where half of the building believes we start with the policy solution first and let the policy drive the culture. But no, I mean, when you think about it, right, when you think about race relations and the civil rights movement, it was the federal government that set a standard that businesses and institutions had to follow, and then what we saw was a shifting of the culture. Whereas I think particularly when it comes to women, we have a double-edged sword where women are playing this role where we also are in such we're in unique positions where we can't push against the grain the way we want to, because we're taking care of children. For many of us, we're sandwich generation women, where we're taking care of someone under the age of 18 as well as someone over the age of 60. So women aren't pushing as hard as they could because we live such precarious lives. Even if the policy shifts, the groundswell that is needed on the ground can't necessarily happen because so many women are struggling to survive.
Sure.
So I think that we have to come up with a game plan that involves the policy piece, that involves a culture shift, but also involves women being able to have the opportunity and the wherewithal to push forward, ask for what they deserve, have the opportunity, the education that they need in order to move their career forward, or to simply create the life that they want, right? Like, most women simply just want to be able to have balance. They want to be able to go and work their job and come home without feeling completely overwhelmed, and that's understandable. But I think women are going to have to play a more critical role in how we, how society chooses to see us, and that's going to be really challenging considering so many of us are simply keeping our head above water. But I always will start with, let the women lead. Let the grassroots percolate up. Let that demand be the demand that drives the movement. And we are seeing it. I think what we're finding with young millennials is they don't necessarily have the same restraints and limitations that the generation before them or the generation before that generation. And so I think we'll see with some of the millennials coming along is a demand for equity in a way that we have not seen for many generations.
Wow, that's nice to hear. Nice to hear.
Yeah, I'm hopeful about the next generation. I know a lot of people are not, but
well,
I am. I think they get it in a way that may not resonate with us, but they do get it in their way.
I think about the struggle that Margaret Sanger had in the turn of the last century,
right?
Just to bring contraceptives into this country, and to hear the kind of debates that you hear. you know, where these people want to make contraceptives unavailable and they want to relitigate Roe v. Wade. And, you know, you wonder, you know, what century are these people living in? My goodness, you know, we're trying to go further and not relitigate what we've done 100 years ago. It's a, it can be disheartening, but, you know, talking to progressive activists like you, that always gives me hope, and I hope it gives my audience hope as well, because there are so many good people with their shoulders to the wheel trying to make some progress. I was wondering if you could pick out a couple of the things that you think are the finest points of the ACA.
The finest points.
The best part of it. The easiest argument, if you will, for the ACA.
Oh, okay. I think the thing that I try to always get women, regardless of age, to hold on to is when we talk about access to women doing better, families being lifted up, this notion that the economy will move forward when women are able to be as autonomous as they need to be to enter into the workforce, we have to start with health. And what the ACA has done is it has given us, you know, preventative services at no cost. We now have this sort of standard, if you will, about where we stand with preventative care, maternity care, and screenings for things like STIs, HIV, things that could impact the longevity and the life of women. And we need to think of this as a generational investment in the future of women. When we think about the economic piece of it as well, though, the idea that this bill, that this law, forgive me, it's law, it is law, I'm saying that again, people keep forgetting that, it is law, it brings an end to gender rating. Do you know how happy that makes me?
Why don't you explain that? Why don't you explain it to people who don't understand the term?
For people who don't know what gender rating is, in essence, it means that prior to Obamacare being implemented, is insurance companies could look at an application, and because you are a woman, and because they know, as I said earlier, you spend more on health care than men do, because we have preventative services that take place like pap smears. When we come, you know, when things go wrong, we go to a doctor to make sure that things can get righted. And because we spend more and because we need more care, insurance companies have the right to charge us more to receive health care. That no longer can take place. It's like you can no longer be denied coverage for having a pre-existing condition. That is huge. That is huge. To be in a family where diabetes, heart disease, and cancer is rampant, that is absolutely huge. So now we have a way to make sure that the most vulnerable people in this country, the majority of which are women, the majority of which are poor women, this is a way that can level the playing field a bit more and help us move a step closer to a health equity model, and I think can really help redesign how women live their lives, the kind of players that we need to be in this country. There's no reason why we should be 51% of the workforce, yet a majority of women live in poverty. And so when we start making the connections between health and wealth, I think people will begin to accept that this law is real. It can be a way of moving America forward, which for those who don't know what that means, it's the opposite of what you see now. Just turn on the news. It doesn't matter which station. It's the opposite of what you see now. It can move America forward. It can move us forward.
Very good. Very good. Well, let me ask you this, and if it's an unfair question, just tell me, and I'll try something new. One of the other questions I have is because so many of us heard many political leaders we trusted talk about single payer, talk about universal care, and we fell so far from that.
Yes.
I'm being very gentle.
You are.
If you could wave your magic wand, which of those promises would you like to get back?
Oh, God, you would make ask a question.
It's a tough one, yeah. But I know you can do it.
Because in the beginning, I was a Medicaid for all person.
Absolutely.
From the very beginning, I thought that was the best way to go.
If we could afford all those missiles, why not?
Yeah, to make sure that everyone was covered. And I think for me, it has always been about which plan, what is the best way we can get absolutely the most people covered so that we can really make sure that we not just are covering people, we can really begin to think through what to me is going to be the next big hurdle of Obamacare. Think through, what does it mean to have a medical infrastructure, a medicalized institution within the U.S. that is built on profit rather than health? And so that conversation has still got to take place, and I think for those of us who were in a different place before Obamacare became a reality, who thought about things like single payer and Medicaid for all, that's going to be our next big hurdle, is how do we make the institution that is making sure that the doctors are available and the hospitals stay open and that you are actually delivering the care, that system is one that values people over profits. And I think that's the next big hurdle. And if I had a magic wand, that would be the thing that I would think needed to be addressed simultaneously rather than the simple conversation about access.
Why do you think this is such a big deal? Because it seems to me, if you really believe in that free market idea, this is the best idea for you, because the insurance companies are still in the mix. The drug companies are still getting their pound of flesh. I don't see how it really hurts those big interests. And I can't believe that these right-wingers believe that somehow their God thinks it's better that people be sick. So what do you think is their motivation?
Well, I think the motivation, and this question actually makes me dig back into it. This question is actually where my labor background and my reproductive health rights and justice background
converge. Oh, go ahead.
Converge.
Go there.
I don't want to go there. You're going to make me go there. Because I think the simple answer is, part of building a free market capitalist system hinges primarily on creating a workforce that can either produce or not. Those who can produce and those who can reproduce are valued over all others. And I think that while many people don't agree with that, you know, I would encourage anyone to read works by Ricky Solinger or Dorothy Roberts to talk about sort of the value that this country places on the exploitable body, right? The body who can get up and produce labor and be that cog in the wheel. I think some of that is just a part of the American way. And so the notion that someone who is poor, who is, you know, going to work, but still can't afford the basic necessities, for a conservative mind, it's sort of like, well, at least they're working. But your necessities are your responsibility. Now, I don't like it. You know, I grew up in a Baptist church where my pastor went to school with Martin Luther King. And so my faith connected the social justice responsibility to make sure that the least of these had as much as I did. And if there was an equity, and even though I was not necessarily the person who had the least amount, or I was not the person directly suffering, that our future as a community, our collective well-being as a nation was linked to my willingness to help that individual. Now, everyone's faith does not teach them that. And I respect that. I completely understand it. Yeah, I respect that, and have had many, many heated late-night conversations about it. But I think that those of us who are now about to take full advantage of Obamacare and know all of the benefits that it is going to bring to women, families, children, even the people who say they don't want it. And, you know, I had the conversation, I remember two or three Christmases ago, people saying things like, you know, I don't want Obamacare, but don't touch my Medicare. And it's sort of like people genuinely are buying into the hype without knowing the facts. And we have to be patient enough and be willing to bring them along and show them rather than simply tell them. And I think that is sort of the work that has to be done between now and when that, you know, the January 1, when people are actually able to go to that first doctor, because no one should have to suffer needlessly. If you can qualify for it, go get it. if you can qualify for it, go get it. And I think that a lot of people, the naysayers, will end up doing that, and the proof will be in the pudding.
You know, one of the other, I think, really, really positive things that's come in the last year or two is the union movement, even as damaged as it is, and it's in tough spot, has clearly put its muscle, put its energy behind the most progressive forces in this country. And that's so wonderful, because I'm old enough to remember when we had anti-war marches or we had social justice marches, there were those who manipulated good union workers against those progressive things. And when I see union movements, whether it be in education or labor or construction or whatever, joining hands with the progressive and the justice seeker, that gives me real hope. It really does.
Yeah.
And
that was not an easy alliance. That was not an easy alliance.
Well, since the Democrats have walked away from union, I suppose they were the only thing left, to put it bluntly.
Right. Right.
I'd sure like to see our good Democratic friends stand up and walk with those on the picket line like they said they were going to do. And
what I have found in working with women, whether they be in the labor movement or the reproductive health rights or justice movements, is that it has a ripple effect. When you help one woman and you do it in a way where you're empowering her to help others, it has this profound ripple effect that just can reshape lives and help, you know, lift up communities. And so I wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to be just, even if it was just a small pebble under the shoe of a massive movement, I wanted to make I wanted to make that kind of a difference. And so this is where I sit. I've done it all. Organized, I've lobbied, I've fundraised, I've run campaigns, and now I get to write and work on legislation at the federal level. But again, it's about me making that one small step to change the world.
Well, thank you so very much. If there was a place you wanted to send our audience to help with your campaigns or an organization you'd suggest they link up with, what would you suggest? Is there a website or a Facebook
yes.
site?
They can go to AmericanProgress.org, and if they go to the health section, they will find me as well as other people working on reproductive justice, as well as faith issues, all things related to women and health, they will find under that page. And feel free to email me at hwilliamson@AmericanProgress.org.
Well, thank you so much, Heidi. Thank you so much for your time and the good work that you're doing. And you're not just a little pebble, you're a boulder.
I will take it. Yes.
You rock.
Got it. Thank you.
Take care of yourself.
All right.
Bye-bye. Thanks for joining us. That was Heidi Williamson, Senior Policy Analyst for Women's Health and Rights Program at the Center for American Progress. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Ellen Schaefer, Director of Trust Women, the Silver Ribbon Campaign, Co-Director of Equal Health Network, and Assistant Clinical Professor at the University of California, San Francisco. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Ellen Schaefer, and remember, we trust women. Hello, Dr. Schaefer. This is Richard Spisak, News Director of Progressive News Network. How are you?
Hi there. Yeah, I was on another call.
Okay, thank you so much. I sure appreciate your time.
You bet.
Dr. Schaefer, first thing I want to say is, I trust women.
So happy to hear it. Thank you very much.
And I think I can say safely for my audience, we trust women. That's for sure. Doctor, I got to thank you for the work that you're doing. It seems that for some peculiar cultural reason, half the country or something less, let's hope much less than half the country, wants to relitigate the 18th century.
Yeah, well, when you're out of ideas, I guess, looking to the past is one way to try to go. I don't think they're the voice of the future, however.
That I think I can safely say you are absolutely right on. Doctor, where do you see this country right now? Obviously, people are voting with their time, with their energy. They support the Affordable Health Care Act. With its flaws, with its imperfections, they are dialing in, they are clicking in.
Yeah.
They want to do this.
They do, clearly.
And yet we see this portion of the political I really can't call it leadership. Anyway, portion of our political state is trying to steer us in the opposite direction and try to steer us in the past. What do you think is the best approach for progressive voices, for thinking people to take right now? How do we best respond to this basically untenable position for our democracy?
Well, you know, I look back to other moments of crisis, you know, when they implemented the healthcare reform, the single-payer system in Canada, people forget. It was the doctors who actually went on strike for some period of time. I don't remember if it was a week, but I mean, there was a lot of uproar. And I think that what we're seeing now is not only a response to really major shifts in our healthcare system, where we always knew there was a lot of money and power at stake, but also major shifts in our political system. I mean, I think the Republican appeal, which has been since the 1970s, 1980s, to get rid of government, let's make sure we discriminate against poor people and minorities and women, you know, it's turning out not to be a real majoritarian position. And I think there are understandable, I don't know if you can say death throes, but expressions of casting about by the opposition. But I think what progressives need to do, as we are doing, is basically just saying, look, this is a democracy. We have laws. We have voted. We've expressed our will. We're continuing to fight back and make sure that we get heard our views are expressed at the ballot box, that our policies are represented by the people that we elect, and to continue to claim the majority, which we are.
You know, we can look at this this new paradigm of healthcare in a lot of ways, and I think those who say, well, look, there's flaws, and I'm one of them. I see flaws in the plan.
For sure.
You know, you can either look at the flaws and say we can make this better if we work it, and those who want to just, you know, well, it's not perfect, let's turn away. You know, somewhere in there we need to come to a thoughtful position, and I think many of us are adopting that. But, you know, it seems to me, short of the naysayers, I'm wondering, you know, you can see where the pharmaceutical industry is in this discussion. I'm just wondering, where are the voices of the doctors? Where is the voices of the physicians? Where is the voices of the AMA? They seem to be absent without leave. Where are they?
Well, I think that the medical profession, like many establishment features of the healthcare system, I think doctors are split. I think there are organizations like the National Physicians Alliance, like Doctors for America, from a somewhat different perspective, Physicians for a National Health Program, that have really tried to say to doctors, you know, there's a better way to do this. We can fight for single payer. We can try to implement this healthcare law in a way that and educate our patients and our communities about what's great about this the Affordable Care Act and help them integrate in. You know, there were others who, you know, just have been saying for quite some time, before the Affordable Care Act, you know, there's managed care, our prerogatives are being taken away, quite legitimately feeling dislocated by the demands of corporate medicine, and turning away. I don't know that it's the case that even the established medical associations, the American Medical Association and so on, are necessarily opposed to the Affordable Care Act. I don't think that's been their position. I think that they have been declining in their presence and membership for quite some time as these gyrations in the economy and the medical care system have influenced their members.
You know, it just seems to me on an ideal level that how could it be wrong that more people have access to health care?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, it seems like an absolutely untenable argument to try to make. You know, I heard last night on one of the news shows, my God, it's the topic, of course, at the time. And I heard a Republican woman say, well, the current system is working perfectly. Mm-hmm. One can only conclude she's either blind and deaf or she's not paying attention. Because people are going bankrupt. People are dying for want of health care. And you can say free market until the cows come home mm-hmm. and sometime later, and that's not going to change the fact that our, quote, ideal health care system is absolutely unavailable to a significant portion of our population.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the problem with organizing around healthcare has always been that most Americans are not sick. Most people are not sick most of the time. Until recently, most people pretty much had secure jobs and had employment-based insurance. Now, that, of course, is changing even more drastically now than it was in the 1990s when we tried, you know, the Clinton health care reform plan and the plan that I worked on in the Senate, a single-payer health care reform. So there's always some number of people, they're younger, they're, you know, it just hasn't been number one on their priority list or their experience. But as you say, you know, there are so many people now who have been uninsured at some period of time, who have somebody in the family who had a disastrous illness that not only is tremendously sad and emotionally draining, but costs a lot. And if you think you were insured, you've got breast cancer, and it turns out you've had an annual limit or a lifetime limit on what your insurance company is going to pay, and you're subjected to these decisions by for-profit insurance companies to basically say, you know, so sorry, not paying you anymore. You know, these are experiences that we accumulate and the people remember, and I think it really has set the basis for the ability to pass the Affordable Care Act and support for the Democrats in Congress and the president saying, you know, sorry, we've passed this. It's been a long struggle. This is something people really need. And, you know, we can see yesterday the overwhelming number of calls to the exchanges. Clearly, plenty of people are eager to get the coverage they need and to move forward with their lives.
Well, many of my listeners are in Florida, and we find ourselves in a state whose governor used to be at least
right.
in some kind of healthcare system, used to manage it, and even if it was only to milk the government's funds, he
right.
at least has a passing acquaintance with the need for real healthcare. And
yeah.
how he could take a position to not make this available to his constituents, it begs the imagination.
Well, you know, Rick Scott has traditionally been on the wrong side, has made money from being on the wrong side. I thought at some point was pretty close to being convicted for being on the wrong side, for basically bilking Medicare through his corporation, Columbia HCA, and I think his perspective on the healthcare system is that this is something that is here to be milked by for-profit corporations, and if you happen to be sick, that's just not something, or poor.
That's a profit center.
Sick and poor, excuse me?
I said, that's a profit center if you're sick.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's absolutely right. So I think that this system, the Affordable Care Act and the exchanges and the Medicaid expansions, you know, all go hand in hand to really creeping forward towards a much more equitable system where more people will be covered and can afford health care. And it is not perfect. I think that the rates on the exchanges are much, much more affordable for the 90% of people who are currently uninsured, who are under 400% of the poverty level, people making about $46,000 a year or less as an individual will get substantial subsidies to be able to afford their health care. So it's certainly a major step forward. On the other hand, there are higher co-pays and deductibles than will work for some people. For older people over 50, I think we really need to look at expanding Medicare down so that we cover start covering younger people in the relatively older population. In other words, include people from age 50 on up. I think those kinds of improvements will make care more affordable and work better for people. But no question about it, the Rick Scott model of let's look at this as a profit center, I think, is increasingly going to be withering away.
If you could give us maybe the top five significant, serious benefits coming from the ACA, what would you characterize them as?
I think the expansion of coverage is absolutely number one. The fact that we've had almost 20% of our population unable to afford or even get access to coverage of any kind has been a real tragedy in our political system. And I think the new coverage through the exchanges, the expansion of Medicaid for lower income people under 133% of the federal poverty level, these are major changes through the Affordable Care Act. Other changes that are important are the coverage without copays and deductibles of preventive care, and particularly the list of preventive benefits for women, which will now be, which have been actually since August of 2012, covered by insurance plans without copays and deductibles, including screening for gestational diabetes and sexually transmitted diseases, and also coverage for contraception. This is really an important benefit. I think the incentives to provide better quality care through the Medicare program, I think that the system is providing incentives to all kinds of improvements in quality, starting with the Medicare program, because that's where the government has the most say over reimbursement and influence with providers. I think the closing of the donut hole for people on Medicare, people who need better affordability of their drugs, are going to find that the cruel and groundless limits in terms of the drug benefit are slowly being closed. And I think that affordability overall, as we see this combination of factors, improvements in coverage and quality and affordability, I think that as those three features come together, coverage, quality, and affordability, we're going to see tremendous improvements both in health and in the security, the health security, the health status, the affordability of our healthcare system as we go forward.
Thank you. I also have a great deal of appreciation of the end to pre-existing conditions.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, you're right, and I think that's partly what I was using as shorthand in terms of coverage. And I think that people, you know, as you say, before, or as you're suggesting, before, even if you had money and went as an individual, if you went to an insurance company and said, I don't have coverage, I'm sick, I need it, that was immediate grounds for them to say, no, we're not going to cover you. Completely, really tragic, and more than that, sensible, just really totally unfair, and destroyed a lot of people's lives. So the fact that now if you don't get your health insurance through an employer and you're sick and you need coverage, that's what the exchanges are for. And I think it's important, again, to get this word out to folks. I mean, most people in the U.S. do still get, most people under 65 do still get their health insurance through their employers. Those plans won't change immediately. The exchanges are really, and the individual insurance mandates really apply to people who are working for small businesses that can't afford to provide insurance, or individuals who aren't covered at work. But increasingly, I think, as we find various mechanisms to make sure that most of our population are covered, I think we'll start seeing changes in employment-based coverage as well.
You know, I kind of am surprised when I hear this, right-wing backlash and this praise of the, quote, free market. And you know, I want someone to say to them, you know, your doctor took a Hippocratic Oath.
Mm-hmm.
They've committed themselves, at least formally, to caring for human beings. Your insurance company never took that oath.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one sitting on the sheet or the desk working on reviewing your policy to say, well, let's see, first I've got to make sure that we help these people out. That is not a consideration. And, mm-hmm. you know, those flaws in all the films that Michael Moore made about healthcare.
Right.
I suppose that these people have forgotten all that. They just don't include that in their thinking. So this magic of the free market just has zero appeal, in my opinion. And let me ask you another question. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the trust campaign?
Sure, I'll be happy to. Let me go back, though, and mention one other thing, because you're mentioning the affordability and the approach of the insurance company.
Sure, go ahead.
The insurance companies. You know, one thing that the Affordable Care Act has done for people with private insurance is, in fact, force more accountability from the insurance industry. And there's a feature that requires insurance companies to spend no more than 20% in the case of smaller plans, or 15% in the case of larger insurance plans, to spend no more than 15% on administration. And insurance companies that don't meet that criterion have to go back and provide rebates, financial rebates in dollars, to their subscribers who have the insurance plans. And that has been something that insurance companies have been forced to do. The Federal Department of Health and Human Services has enforced the law and has forced some insurance companies to send checks back to their subscribers. So it's kind of been remarkable what an impact that's had on insurance companies, you know, curtailing some of their practices that have misused our premiums. So I just wanted your listeners to be aware of that.
Absolutely.
As well.
Great point.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So the Trust Women Silver Ribbon campaign is something that grew out of the Center for Policy Analysis. In 2010, we were watching the development of the Affordable Care Act and the provisions in the Affordable Care Act that had to do with coverage of abortion as well as contraception. And noticing, you know, as you say, that there are these kind of 18th century approaches to stopping time from moving forward, that there were objections to covering contraception completely, demands that the Affordable Care Act find a different way to pay for abortions from how it's typically done in most health insurance plans. And we kind of looked at this and said, my goodness, you know, 30% of people in this country, 30% of women will have had at least one abortion by the time they're 45. Abortion's been legal in this country since 1973, since the Supreme Court decision. Just about 99.9% of heterosexually active Americans, regardless of their religious affiliation, use contraception or have used contraception at some point. Looking at the members of Congress who were making a fuss about these issues, you know, that we don't see a lot of families anymore with 9 kids or 12 kids. You know, members of Congress, like everybody else, use contraception, and they have, you know, an average of 2 or 3 kids if they're married or in a relationship. So we're kind of going, where is this coming from? We came up with a few ideas. Dr. Sophia Yen, who's an adolescent medicine doctor here in California and has been very active in educating adolescents and her community and various organizations over the years about reproductive rights, we came together with Dr. Yen and came up with the idea that what we really need, one of the things that we need, is a way for people who do support reproductive rights and understand how important that is for both men and women and families in general, for women to be able to express our personhood and our right to the families we want to have when we want to have them, and the social and economic and political support toward that whole range of rights, that we wanted to have a symbol that expressed our positive feelings about all of those issues. So we came up with a silver ribbon, a pin that says Trust Women, and it's a positive expression of the value of science over ideology, and offer it to be worn by people who support access to contraception and safe legal abortion. And we also created a website and a coalition of organizations encouraging groups to come together and work together, because one of the other things that we felt was important about the women's health movement is that we find ways to overcome our differences and our fragmentation and really act as a strong coalition. So we've got over 80 groups that have participated in January of each year in celebrating the anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion. We do that towards the end of January. We have a website where people can go and order Trust Women Silver Ribbon pins, and where looking, clearly there have been some important shifts recently with the in the religious community, with the statements by the Catholic Pope, Pope Francis, that the campaign by the Catholic Church against lifestyle issues, against gay people, gay practices, and also abortion, calling on people of faith to re-examine those campaigns in the context of the importance of other factors that the religious community should be pursuing, peace and economic justice, I think is really a very significant shift. And we're going to be looking at how to promote discussion and unity and ideas about health and equality, with our friends in the religious community, to see how we can integrate this new thinking into, among other things, the issue we were talking about before, making sure that there is really fair coverage and healthcare services provided, including through the Affordable Care Act and through state and public healthcare systems.
You know, one of the things that I was concerned about recently, I heard about, and I don't recall whether it was on a state level, was it maybe some state that wanted to give control over birth control access and women's healthcare access to supervisors and employers?
Yeah, right. Yeah, there has been, in fact, that was included by the Tea Party in the conditions that they're now that they have been demanding in order to run the government. So I don't know if folks are familiar with this, but the most immediate demand that the Tea Party Republicans have had was calling on backtracking on the Affordable Care Act. But there's a whole other long list of backwards policies that the Republicans have been demanding really since 2011, since they took over the House. One of the first laws that the Republicans passed was H.R. 3. The first one was H.R. 1 to repeal the Affordable Care Act. H.R. 3 basically would have said that hospitals could let women die rather than provide an abortion if that were the choice, and they wouldn't face any legal consequences. It was really a shocking blast from
the past. You have to wonder, what constitution are they reading that your employer gets to decide what rights you have?
Right.
It's absolutely preposterous.
Yep.
But for an organization that's immune to science and facts, I guess anything goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, they're basically saying that if you have an employer-provided, and they're going to court and making these arguments, if you have employer-provided health insurance and your employer decides that it is morally objectionable or objectionable for whatever reason to that employer that you should use contraception, that employer has the right to block you from using your health insurance plan to pay for contraception. It is really insane, and there is no legal basis for it. These cases have been tried in court. They've been tried in court by directly religious organizations, including Catholic Charities, and they have historically had no basis. But I think that these political passions, these fads, kind of feed upon themselves, and the more outlandish ideas are that and grievances that people are allowed to express and that get good currency in the media. You know, I think people just go a little hog wild, but there is no basis for it in U.S. law, and I think that people, as we are doing now in the face of this government shutdown, I think really need to mobilize, and I say progressive people, but however people identify ourselves politically, I think anybody who reads, who's literate, who really understands that, you know, democracy is a place for debate and for reason and for intelligence and for solidarity, for people recognizing our rights to live our lives the way we want to, and the need for us to support each other and have a government that's based on reason and support for our population. We really need to come together and say, you know, the craziness is what it is. It's gone far enough. We need to speak up for the rights that we enjoy, that we fought for, and those are rights to health care, those are rights to civilized and well-informed debate, and for respect for each other's personal freedoms and personal decisions.
I couldn't agree with you more. One other thing I wanted to ask you about is, I understand you worked on a recent edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
What a tremendous volume, and what huge impact that had on both original, and I'm sure the new version will have the same level of impact. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, sure. Thank you very much. You know, Our Bodies, Ourselves, I just sent a copy to my to one of my nieces who was having a bat mitzvah, and my her grandma had said, oh, you know, she knows all about that. Kids today, they know all about these things. And I sent it to her, and I got a note back from her mom who said she's been locked up in her room for the last 3 hours. I don't know if we're ever going to see her again. And Our Bodies, Ourselves really has and it's interesting that it still has that effect on people. It started out in the 1970s.
Sure.
And remember, abortion had just become legal. There were virtually no women gynecologists. There were hardly any women doctors. It was legal not to include. It was legal not to hire women for various professions. It was legal not to include women in professional education of all sorts. A lot of our visits to the doctor were, you know, we're going to talk to you in Latin and tell you what diseases you have and not include you in figuring out what you need to know about your body. And it really started off as a mimeographed bunch of pages that the Boston Women's Health Book Collective put together to say to people, you know, you really can know what's going on in your body, and you should, and you can have more control over it, and you can make alliances with your healthcare providers if you know what's going on and they know that you want to discuss these things. So Our Bodies, Ourselves has always been kind of a how-to manual. Here's what's going on in your reproductive system, in your healthcare system, and in the political system that has so much to do with how we get healthcare and the kind of the affordability of healthcare, the availability of healthcare. And so that there are a number of chapters. It's always been a group effort. There are chapters on lifestyle, on aging, on sexuality, on biology, and also, of course, on politics and the healthcare system itself. And the politics chapter is one that I have helped to write and to edit over the last couple of editions. It's really quite wonderful. It has a lot of resources. There's now an online analog. So if people buy the book, Our Bodies, Ourselves, there's also a website and a lot of resource information that you can find in the book and also on the Our Bodies Ourselves website that will refer people to all kinds of background information about how you can become politically active, how you can become active in healthcare issues, how you can look up resources if you want to know something about a particular condition that you have. And again, if you want to know about other organizations in your area, in an area of interest to you, you can find incredible information and very useful information on the Our Bodies Ourselves website. And of course, I'm happy to say that Our Bodies Ourselves is also a proud partner of the Trust Women Silver Ribbon campaign. We have a very close and similar close relationship and similar approach to a lot of the issues we've been discussing today. We work together on letting people know about the Affordable Care Act and also alternatives to the Affordable Care Act, looking towards a more publicly financed universal system that will cover everyone in the country. So it really is quite a wonderful organization and quite a wonderful book, and appreciate your awareness of it.
You know, I remember back when that first version came out, and I lived in a commune situation with a bunch of very intelligent people of both sexes, and I remember how revolutionary that book was back then.
Mm-hmm.
And these were educated people. This were people who had a good grounding in sciences, and yet so much of it was a revelation to us. And I can only imagine how many lives that has touched. And you must be so proud to be contributing again to helping people understand themselves, their own sexuality, and issues that are still, unfortunately, far too taboo for our own good.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, even at that time, and you know, the situation has changed to some extent, one of the things that we talked about was the right to access to abortion, certainly, but also the fact that poor women and women of color were being sterilized against their will, and often without any information that this was being done to them. And I think that the awareness of the different treatment and the diverse circumstances that face women and continue to face women to some extent in our country, based on sexual preference, certainly based on income level, based on race, based on where you live, you know, we continue to see these kinds of disparities, and it's great to see books and coalitions like the Boston Women's Health Collective and Our Bodies Ourselves and Silver Ribbon and justice organizations like reproductive justice organizations like Sister Song and other groups really saying, you know, we need to link our understanding of health issues and healthcare issues with social justice issues generally. How important it is to understand that there are different ramifications for people depending on where you live, on what your income is, on your general power within society, about how long you're going to live, about how healthy your communities are. And we really need to address all of these issues to make sure that we have a just and healthy society.
Well, Dr. Schaefer, thank you so much for the work that you're doing to remind people that all human beings have human rights, women as well as men. You're making important progress for our society. Thank you so much for the work that you do.
Thanks very much.
And hope to talk to you again soon.
Looking forward. Thanks for all your work.
That was Dr. Ellen Schaefer, director of the Trust Women Silver Ribbon Campaign, co-director of the Equal Health Network, and an assistant clinical professor at the University of California, San Francisco. I want to close with another issue that's important to men and women alike, families across the United States. It's the TPP. It's been broken down by some activists to focus on some of the areas that you should know about. TPP affects food safety. Any of our government food safety regulations on pesticide levels, bacterial contamination, fecal exposure, toxic additives, food labeling, organic country of origin, animal welfare approved, GMO-free, that are stricter than international standards could be ruled as illegal trade barriers. Our government would then have to revise our consumer protections to comply with weaker standards. Fracking. Our Department of Energy would lose its authority to regulate exports of natural gas to any TPP partnership nation. This would create an explosion of the destructive fracking process across our country, for both foreign and U.S. corporations would export fracked gas from America to member nations without any DOE, Department of Energy, review of the environmental or economic impacts on local communities or on our national interests. Jobs. U.S. corporations would get special foreign investor protections to limit the cost and risk of relocating their factories to low-wage nations that sign on to this agreement. So an American corporation thinking about moving a factory would know it's guaranteed a sweetheart deal if it moves operations to a TPP nation like Vietnam. This would be an incentive for corporate chieftains to export more of our middle-class jobs. Oddly enough, they never export any CEO jobs, although I'm sure there are CEOs across the third, fourth, and fifth world, whatever they are, who'd be thrilled to be CEO of, oh, let's say, Goldman Sachs for about, you know, $10,000 a year. Drug prices. Big Pharma would be given more years of monopoly pricing on each of their patents and be empowered to block distribution of cheaper generic drugs. Besides artificially keeping everyone's prices high, this would be a death sentence to many people suffering from cancer, HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, and other treatable diseases in impoverished lands. Banksters! Let's not forget the banksters. Wall Street, the financial giants, and other Trans-Pacific Partnership countries would make out like bandits, as opposed to the kind of bandits they're making out like now. The deal explicitly prohibits transaction taxes, such as the proposed Robin Hood tax, that would shut down speculators who have repeatedly triggered financial crises and economic crashes around the world. It restricts firewall reforms that separate consumer banking from risky investment banking. It would roll back reforms the government adopted to fix extreme bank deregulation regime that caused Wall Street's 2007 crash. And it provides an escape from national rules that would limit the size of too-big-to-fail behemoths. Again, don't forget, you can get all the details at averyvoice.com. Averyvoice.com, A-V-E-R-Y, Avery, like every voice, averyvoice.com. All the details on the news. Internet freedom. Corporations hoping to lock up and monopolize the internet failed in Congress last year to pass their repressive Stop Online Privacy Act, SOPA. However, they've slipped SOPA's most pernicious provisions into TPP. So the deal would transform internet service providers into a private Big Brother police force, empowered to monitor our user activity, arbitrarily take down our content, cut off our access to the internet, and top that off, consumers would be assessed mandatory fines for something as benign as sending your mom a receipt recipe you got off a paid site. You brigand, you. Public services, Trans-Pacific Partnership rules would limit how governments regulate as public services as utilities, transportation, education, including restricting policies meant to ensure our broad and universal access to those essential needs. One insidious rule says that member countries must open their service sector to private competitors, which would allow corporate providers to cherry-pick the profitable customers and sink public service. Lori Wallach, director of Global Trade Watch, correctly calls the Trans-Pacific Partnership a corporate coup d'etat. Nations that join must conform their laws and rules to TPP structure, effectively supplanting U.S. sovereignty, canceling our people's right to be self-governing, and worse, it creates a virtual permanent corporate rule. Do you hear that? Creates a virtually permanent corporate rule. Is it impossible to stop? No. There's also a broad, well-organized, politically experienced coalition of grassroots groups which has stopped other deals and will do it again. We the people can protect our democratic rights from the threat of corporate usurpation. Check out globaltradewatch.org. And once again, I'm your host, Rick Spezak, news director of Progressive News Network. Next week, it's a Progressive Journalist Roundup. So tune in next week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And we're going to leave you with a little something to stimulate the giving principle.
to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream.
Thanks for tuning in.
With peace and glory ahead, why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly down. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suit, ah, gee, we looked swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare?
Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen. We'll talk to you next week.